November of 2012, we witnessed the fall of General David Petraeus, who had had a meteorite career to the top. He was in the top government officialdom. He was the director of the CIA. He was a director of national intelligence. He was a director of the White House Security and National Intelligence. But because of indiscretions and inappropriateness that was discovered because of an affair with Paula Broadwell and some of the scandal that went on there, he resigned his position. During the investigation of that, the general that also came to light was General Allen, who was the highest ranking commander that we had at the time in Afghanistan. He was about to be appointed Supreme Allied Commander in Shape Belgium to NATO, but he had to resign as well, and that nomination was pulled back by President Barack Obama. About that same time, General Sinclair was fired for inappropriate behavior and a sexual assault. There was a General Moody that went down. There was a General Jackson for lying and making falsified reports. One of my favorites at the time was Vice Admiral Giardina, who was the Vice Commander of Strategic Command. Very close to my heart was this situation. He used to be a boss of mine as I worked in Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. Admiral Giardina was the Vice Commander of Strategic Command, and so therefore he had literally the nuclear surety program of the United States in the palm of his hand. And he was caught across the river there in Iowa at a casino passing off counterfeit poker chips. These all came in a succession in 2012, 2013, and just mystified everyone and what was happening, what was going on. And all the senior service schools for all the branches of the military were in this frenzy trying to find the silver bullet to try to stop this kind of behavior and stop the hemorrhaging and all these senior officers and what had become of them. You know, as Christians, I kind of had a different worldview there when I was at the United States Army War College. I didn't have the silver bullet. I don't believe we have that. But I think our worldview, shaped by the Bible, we understand what's happening. We understand the problem for what it is. And we were able to get some kind of insight into that. For instance, if you were in ancient Israel, there would not have been a better time for you to be there except for under the reign of Solomon. Solomon's reign as the king of Israel, the borders were broader. It was more prosperous. There was more security. There was more peace. There was more wealth. And we don't see any greater king than King Solomon, a man that was so humble, he had asked God for nothing but wisdom. And so therefore, God gives him everything. And he never stands taller than when he's on his knees in 1 Kings chapter 8 in front of one of the ancient wonders of the ancient world, which is the temple of Jehovah that he had just got finished building. And he's on his knees with his hands outspread and he's saying, "Oh God, have mercy and grace upon this people. When we come forward and ask for forgiveness, do hear and forgive." Very shortly thereafter, though, that we read in 1 Kings chapter 11, 9 and 10, for Jehovah was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from Jehovah, the God of Israel, who appeared unto him twice and commanded him concerning this thing. You could read in your Bible, this very thing. Thou shalt not go after foreign gods. Thou shalt not go after other gods. And then with some kind of despondency, we read the last phrase. But he kept not that which God commanded. I'll tell you what, in that same chapter, to make a particular point, you try to guess who this is to. God is speaking through a prophet, and he tells a man, he said, "And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command you, and you walk in my ways and do that which is right in mine eyes, and you keep the statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, then I will be with thee, and I will build you a sure house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee." You know who he said that to? That's 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 38. That is speaking to Jeroboam. Now, would that surprise us a little bit? If you know your Bible and you know your history a little bit about the divided kingdom, that surprises us a little bit. that he's making that promise to Jeroboam, because we see Jeroboam as what? The first evil king of the northern kingdom after the division. And after him is a succession of kings that never turn it around. And Israel goes down into a spiral to their very destruction in 722 BC. When Shalmaneser comes in and Samaria falls and he absolutely obliterates the northern kingdom and it disappears from the pages of history. And we think, well, you know what? As we talked this morning, John Kaplan had an excellent class in Isaiah talking about the remnant. And we think, well, you know, God allowed that kingdom to divide. He was going to keep a remnant in the south. He's going to let the northern kingdom go their way. After about 210 years, he's going to allow them to just live in what they have created, and they destroy themselves. You know, there's enough truth in that for us to forget something. God's long-suffering and his mercy and his grace and his love was that he pleaded and gave Jeroboam the same promise that he gave David, that history could be different. We could see that Jeroboam and his lineage and his seed stayed on the throne in the northern kingdom and stayed that way throughout time. But you know what we read? We read eight family different names, different seed lines in the northern kingdom as God begins to churn through them, looking for some kind of leader of moral character that will stand up and lead his people the way they should. I mean, no more did God promise Jeroboam. Listen, he's a nobody. He's given that by God. And he says, if you do this, I will do this for you. And in chapter 12 and 26, we see that Jeroboam began to counsel himself in his own heart. Because he says, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. Was that a problem? It wasn't to Jehovah God, but he made it a problem. Jeroboam thought it was going to be a problem. And now he's going to come up with the solution. So now he's not going to God for it. He comes up with it, moves the place of worship to Dan and Bethel. He changes the mode, the object, the medium of worship, changes out the priesthood, comes up with a heathen, paganistic type religion of idolatry, and leads Israel into total demise. How about this? While we're playing the Guess Who game, who is this to? Who does this describe to you? But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up so that he did corruptly and trespassed against Jehovah, his God. I know you're all Bible students. You're coming up with names right and left, right? You know who that is. Oh, we don't? We having trouble with that one? Well, maybe I'll read you the last part of the verse. I kind of left that out, didn't I? It says, for he went into the temple of Jehovah to burn incense upon the altar of incense. Oh, Colonel, that's an easy one. That's Uzziah. That's right. 2 Chronicles 26 and 16, that's a good king, Uzziah. Somehow, some way, got to the very pinnacle, the very apogee of his reign, and walks in to do that which is not authorized. He ends up with leprosy the rest of his days, sitting over in a little house outside the palace where nobody wants to go, nobody wants to see his face. His son reigns in his stead because his heart was lifted. Now, why didn't we know that was Uzziah in the beginning? When I said when he was strong, his heart was lifted up. And he did corruptly, he trespassed against Jehovah his God. Why didn't you come up with Uzziah then? Because that statement describes every man and woman and child of responsibility. Because it's a human characteristic. It's the old farmer's wisdom. You know, when I think of farmer wisdom, I think of Jason Holliday. I don't know who you think of, but he probably never said this, but he could have said something like this, because that guy, he'll just shoot straight right to the heart, gets it right every time. The old farmer says, well, when you don't need God, you don't need God. And what was he saying was that when the rains come, your crops grow up, it dries out enough to get them out of the field, you're able to harvest them, you guessed right the year before what to plant, the market's great, you get them to market, you make that money, you got the security, you got the prosperity, everything's going well. When you don't see the need for God, you don't live like you need God. And that's every one of us. And that certainly is of great men who rise to great heights of leadership and cannot stop themselves. Now you say, okay, What about the great kings of the South, though? I mean, you've picked out a couple of things here. How about some of the great kings? We know we've got some great kings, don't we? If you think of some of the great kings of the Southern Kingdom, who are you thinking of? Uzziah was a great king, by the way. He just didn't end up so well. How about Hezekiah? Are you thinking about him? Sure, he's a great king. He probably was one of the best, if not the best. I mean, for the Southern Kingdom, he does hardly anything wrong. He's got some advantages. We'll talk about that in a second. But here we are reading about Hezekiah in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. And in verse 24 and 25, and verse 24 says this, "And now it came to pass, or in those days, Hezekiah was sick even unto death. And he prayed unto Jehovah, and he spake unto him, and he gave him a sign." Now, what's that talking about? That's kind of a summary statement, isn't it? Hezekiah is sick even unto death. Isaiah comes to him, that we talked about this morning in class. Isaiah walks up to him and says, "Get your act together, you're dying. End of your days are here, get your act together, you're dying." And then he heads out of town. Hezekiah begins to pray, doesn't he? Pretty fervent at that point, isn't he? So he's down on his knees, down on his face, asking for life. And then Jehovah God comes to Isaiah and goes, "I've heard his prayer, go back." So Isaiah goes back to Hezekiah and says, "God's heard your prayer. He's going to grant you life." And so Hezekiah says, "Well, what is the sign? What sign is he going to give me to assure me that I've got life?" He says, "Well, it could be either your choice. The sun's shadow can go forward again 10 spaces or go back 10 paces. It's up to you." And he thinks a whole lot like us, not thinking about the solar system and all the intricacy of the universe. But he thinks, "Well, it's tougher for the sun to go back 10 paces. So that's what I'm going to ask for." And that's exactly what happens. Now, here's a man that had seen the destruction of the northern kingdom. Advantage or disadvantage? Advantage. Why? Well, that'd be like China coming in and taking over Canada and Mexico. Get your attention? Would that get our attention? Would you then start thinking, "Wait a minute, life as we know it is about to change drastically. Maybe some of these little petty feuds we got going are not so important." Hezekiah gets to look across the border and he gets to see the Assyrians and he gets to see them demolish his kinfolk. He gets his act together, doesn't he? And then the Assyrian king Sennacherib comes down and surrounds Jerusalem and says, "I think I've got you now, like a bird in a cage," is what he says. And Hezekiah, then he starts stripping the temple of all the things that he can to try to pay him off. God probably not very pleased, but sooner or later, Hezekiah realizes where he needs to go. Praise to God, and he hears this prayer again, sends an angel, and death passes over, and 185,000 soldiers are killed. Sennacherib hears a spirit, gets called, goes back to Nisroch, his god, gets killed by his son in the temple. All of that happens, and Hezekiah is witness to all of this. You pray to God for life, and a prophet comes and says, "He's heard your prayer, he grants you life," and then you ask for a sign, and he gives you a sign. Pretty good relationship? Sure. Fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Doesn't get much better than that. Hezekiah is right on top of the world, and that's what he thinks, because the very next verse, in verse 25, what do we read? But he was angry with him. Why? Because Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him, for his heart was lifted up. Can you imagine? So there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. Well, maybe your money's on Josiah. Maybe Josiah can pull this out. Now, Josiah, we're going to go well, end well. Everything's going to be fine. We finally find a king after God's own heart. Here's Josiah. And what do we read about him in 2 Chronicles 35 and 22? "Nevertheless, Josiah does not turn his face from him and disguises himself that he might fight with him and hearkens not unto the word of Necho by the mouth of God and goes to fight with him in the valley of Megiddo." Who's he disguising himself from? You notice, who's Necho here? He's a heathen pagan king from Egypt. You notice how God works? He'll speak through anybody he wants in the Old Testament, and he chooses Necho, the heathen king, and he gives Josiah a message. And you think Josiah knows that? Sure he does. That's why he disguises himself. Did it work? No, he found his demise just like the Turkish army did in 1918, right there in the Valley of Megiddo when General Allenby destroyed him. So Josiah's gone. His heart's lifted up. No longer listening to Jehovah his God. when I got to officer training school. The Air Force said, here's the great value, this is the big test, and that's integrity. And they defined integrity by saying, it's doing the right thing when no one's looking. That's a pretty tough test, isn't it? I don't think all of us can meet that test all the time, but pretty good test. But what I tell the cadets, I really wanted them to start thinking about this problem of moral character. So I said, that's not the toughest test. And they say, well, what do you mean? Doing the right thing when no one's looking. I said, the right thing could easily be defined by your peer group. Well, what are you talking about? Well, the researchers in psychology out of the Ivy League school said there's a stage in adult developmental stage that's immature, it's undeveloped completely, and it's called socialization. Now, this isn't a homeschooler's definition. No, this is Ivy League schooler. These are the Ivy League university professors and the psychologists have nothing to do with God or the Bible. And they said, socialization is a stage that you go through and it's defined this way. Your values are dictated to you by your peer group. And then they come out with the real astounding statement that said 90% of all adults in America, we estimate, are still stuck in socialization, never grow out of it. So I said, all right, so if you're going to do the right thing when no one's looking, that could be the right thing defined by your peer group. Here's a tougher test. I said, that's moral character. Nobody liked that word in the Air Force. Man, they got all over me. What are you talking about, moral character? That smacks too preachy. I said, well, that's what it's supposed to. I want you to think about this. And they said, well, how do you define moral character? I said, it's what you do, doing the right thing when everyone is looking and they disagree with you. Then we got that dog looking at a watch thing. They're like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? How can it be the right thing then when everybody disagrees with you? And I said, that's what you have to determine. That there's an eternal moral standard and it is not dictated by the crowd and in numbers. The best example we can think of is 1 Kings chapter 22, one of my favorite chapters in all the Bible. I had Doug read that for us, so it just kind of reminded us of that, kind of dust off the cobwebs if you haven't been through that in a while. Jehoshaphat, good king, bad king. Yeah, good king, right? Very good king. From the southern kingdom, from Jerusalem. And where is he in this point? He's in Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. He's with a king called King Ahab. Good king or bad king? As evil as we read about. Right? Did anybody, when you hear that chapter and when you do your Bible reading and you find out that Jehoshaphat is sitting up there with King Ahab, does anybody's hair on the back of their neck stand up? Like right away, you say, what is he doing there? You know, in the flying world, we used to have a phrase that we'd always listen for. Lonnie probably knows this. In the aviation industry, you listen for this phrase right before a pilot begins to do something dumb or dangerous to kill himself or somebody else. He says, watch this. Folks, this is the watch this phrase of this chapter with Jehoshaphat and his kingdom. This is the watch this. He's sitting up with King Ahab. You know what Isaiah says is, why clasp hands with those that are outside of God? Later on, King Jehoshaphat's going to have a prophet come up to him. And this prophet, Jehu, is going to tell him, he says, God's going to ask you, why do you love those who hate Jehovah God? And that's not the kind of love your neighbor kind of thing. That's just, you're unequally yoked, aren't you? You're hanging around with the people that you don't need to be hanging around. You've heard it before, parents, haven't you? Well, how can I influence these people if I don't hang out with them? You've probably done that at work. Well, how can I influence them unless I hang out with them at these parties? Besides that, I'm only a designated driver. It's the watch this statement of a Christian life. This is a watch this statement of Jehoshaphat. Not part of this story, but does it ever have a ramification for the southern kingdom? Jehoshaphat names his son what? Jehoram. What does Ahab name his middle son? Jehoram. Isn't that cute? They both named their sons the same thing. They've been hanging out together. They named their sons the same thing. When Jehoram's going to go to the throne, who's his wife? Her name is Athaliah, I suppose the way you'd say it. Her name's Athaliah. Who is she? She's the daughter of King Ahab. I don't know that her mother's Jezebel, but we're getting really close, aren't we? She's the daughter of the most evil king ever to sit on the throne in the northern kingdom. And his son marries her. You think that's going to bid well for him? So he goes on. He's an evil king, even though he had a righteous father. And then he dies because he's so evil, and his son tries to take the throne, and God kills him off because he's evil as well. Who takes the throne at that point? Athaliah does. How many Bible people you talk to all the time and say, well, the kings of Israel, kings of the north, kings of the south, kings, kings, kings. Did you know there was a queen that reigned in the southern kingdom for 6 bloody, terror-filled years? Why is she even there? How did she enter the picture? Oh, thank you, Jehoshaphat. So it does have ramifications, doesn't it? 2 Chronicles chapter 19 and verse 2, he's going to be chastised for it. But that should be raising us up right now. What is he doing in the north? Point number 2 is, do you notice that Jehoshaphat says in verse 4, first of all, this King Ahab, which we're not naming now, he's being called the King of Israel. You can figure that out for yourselves when you're doing your reading. But the King of Israel says to him, he says, wilt thou go to battle with me? Go to Ramoth-Gilead. And oh, Jehoshaphat says, I am as you are. My people are your people. My horses are as your horses. And Jehoshaphat says to the King of Israel, inquire first, I pray thee, for the word of Jehovah. Now, I'm no mathematician, but is that first? Is that first? No, Jehoshaphat, you've already packed your bags. You left Jerusalem. You went up to Samaria. You're hanging out with the most evil king, somebody that's turned their back on. Unless you think that this is a joke, Ahab is a worshiper of Baal. You know what that is? You know when you go to a place today in the Middle East that they've taken and they've done the excavations? There's, you know how you got these nice cemeteries outside these country churches all over Alabama? Well, they had their cemeteries too outside these places of worship of Baal. They're little jars like this with little infants in it that they kill and they sacrifice to Baal. That's who Ahab is. And there's prostitutes, male and female. That's who Ahab is. And Jehoshaphat, a man after God, is sitting up there with him. Yeah, it's a big deal. And now he says, oh, well, I've got this alliance. He asked you if you're going to go with him, and you said, yeah, my army's your army. Let's go. Oh, first, let's inquire Jehovah. That's not first. Not first. And so 400 prophets come in. You think prophecy's a pretty lucrative job there in Ahab's day? 400! Larger than this crowd. 400 religious, zealous people. How can they all be wrong? How can they all be wrong? Come on now, there's 400. They're speaking for Jehovah. They've heard his word. They're telling you what it is. Go up there, do this thing. Let's get it done. Now, what did Jehoshaphat hear? What did he see? Did he see tattoos? Did he see a different accent? Did he see the way they dressed? What was it about these pagans and these idolaters that didn't match the prophets of Israel? I say tattoos because not that I'm picking on anybody in here, but a prophet of Israel would not have had a tattoo because they were, you know, they were frowned upon to put ink on your arms and marks and all that. The Israelites didn't do that. Did not do that. But when they joined pagan nations and idolatrous nations, they sure did. So I don't know what it is. I don't know what happened. He's listening to 400 people, but now he's like, wait a minute, I smell something. He's like, no, is there not a prophet of Jehovah besides that we may inquire of him? Right? Verse 7. Is there not a prophet of Jehovah besides, that we may not acquire of him? So he's looking for something else. He's now beginning to insist on the word of God, isn't he? And so that's when it comes into play, this guy named Micaiah, and he says, you know, I don't know why he didn't name Elijah. I don't know where Elijah is right now, but he does name Micaiah, and he says, I hate him. I hate him because he never prophesies good of me. Oh, not let the king say so. Let's listen to him. Okay, so the messenger in verse 13 that goes to call Micaiah says, behold now, the words of the prophets declare good all with one voice. Let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word of one of them, and speak thou good. Why can't you be like everybody else? Can everybody be wrong? Why can't you just quit this little act of yours and be like everybody else? Why can't you be like them? Won't that be just, everybody's getting along so much better. Why has this guy got to come in here and stir it up? And so Micaiah says what should be on the tip of the tongue of every man and woman in God. He says, as Jehovah liveth, what Jehovah saith unto me, that will I speak. Doesn't matter what the crowd does. And so Micaiah gets ushered in. And here he is, 400 prophets, probably an imperial guard for both kings, probably brings a silent crowd to about 500 that are all staring at this guy. He comes walking in. There's the evil son of Omri with his crown down around his brow and his royal robes, and he's sitting there on the throne looking down on him. What have you to say? We're going to go up to Ramoth-Gilead. Micaiah says, go up, you'll prosper. God will deliver it in your hand. Go on up. A lot of people don't get this. I'm a sarcastic guy. I get this. And so did Ahab, because he says, I told you. I want you to speak the truth. You tell me what God told you. You think there's something there in Ahab that he knows? Even though he's listened to 400 prophets, he's not satisfied either, is he? He knows he's got a different message. So he says, no, I told you to speak me the truth. And Micaiah said, I saw all of Israel scattered upon the mountains like sheep without a shepherd. And Jehovah God said, these have no master. Let every man return to his house in peace. And then he goes off and he tells Jehoshaphat, I told you. I told you this guy. That's what he's going to say to me every time. Why would I listen to him? And then Micaiah, kind of emboldened, thinks, I'll just go ahead and tell him the whole truth, the whole ugly truth. He says, you know, I had this vision and I saw the host of heaven standing around God and all these different spirits walking up to him. And he said, who's going to entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? He goes, and one of them said, I'll put a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets. And he said, you know what? You will. You'll be successful. You will entice him. Go ahead and do it. And you know what the Bible tells you? That God put a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets. You go home and chew on that. If your heart is ready to run after a lie, God will allow it. He killed one of his prophets for listening and believing in a lie, killed him with a lion on the way back to Judah. A lie that you believe in is no excuse as the people of God. Here's a great question for you. How many people have to repeat a lie? How many people have to believe in a lie? How many people have to talk about it and use that lie before it becomes truth? We're still looking for that number, aren't we? And so now, this lying spirit from the 401st prophet, and it deserves and earns him what? He says, hey, you know what? Take this guy off, put him in prison, and feed him with the bread and the water of affliction till I come home in peace. And he says, if you come home in peace at all, Ahab, God hasn't spoken for me. And of course, Zedekiah, the leader of the 400 prophets, comes over there and just busts him in the mouth and goes, which way did the Spirit of God go for me to speak to you? And he says, you'll know it when you're hiding in your closet someday. I don't know if that was a prophecy of the fall of Samaria or if that was to Zedekiah personally. But Micaiah gets carried off. Now here's a question for you. The word of God, who did it affect? Jehoshaphat insisted, didn't he? First, it's like, well, inquire first. Well, it's not first. But after 400 prophets, he gets a little nervous. He says, no, isn't there someone else? So he's insisting on the word of God. Does it change him at all? No, he jumps in his chariot. He's gone. He's going up to Ramoth-Gilead. Does it change Zedekiah and the 400 prophets? Do some of them back off their message and go, wait a minute, you know, maybe we should think this thing through? No, not in one of them. How about the evil King Ahab? Does it change him at all? Does it affect him? Yes, it does, doesn't it? Not enough. But what does Ahab do? Now that he's listened to all his buddies and the 400 yes men, but he's listened to one guy that he hates, but what does he do? He says, he goes up to Jehoshaphat and he goes, you know what? Hey, you put on your royal robes. You get into the royal chariot. And hey, I'm going to go incognito. I kind of got this thing here. I'm going to disguise myself. Right? Who's he disguising himself from? He goes into battle disguised. But you know, there's one stray arrow. Even though he's not recognized, there's this stray random arrow that it says that an archer had just shot. The American Standard says peradventure. The ESV says at random. And this arrow of God going up through the air, coming down in a crowd with a melee, with the moving chariots and all of this, it finds one man. It finds Ahab. And not only finds Ahab, but it finds just between the joints of the armor. And not just between the joints of the armor, but in a vital area of his body so that he begins to bleed out in the bottom of the chariot. The rest of the Bible is a ghastly scene of him being propped up in a chariot, bleeding out and dying as he's just tied up in a chariot and they're riding around the battlefield so that they won't think their king is dead and gone. And then you can go back and read the rest of that about the cleanup and the Jezebel and all that in your casual Bible reading. Doesn't affect Jehoshaphat at all, but it does affect King Ahab. Now let me ask you, who's the leader in this story? Is it Zedekiah with 400 prophets behind him? Is he a leader? Sounds like leading. He's got a bunch of big followers, but no moral character. Is Jehoshaphat the leader in this? What did Jehoshaphat do? He lost his vision, right? Last lesson, we talked about moral character acting with conviction upon a vision. And he lost the vision. He lost the vision of God and what he was supposed to be about. Ahab certainly isn't a leader, taking his entire nation to destruction. You got one leader. He's back in prison, wasting away. We don't know that he ever got out. You realize that? And you say, wait a minute. Why are you calling him a leader? How many followers did he have? How many people followed Micaiah? That's the point, isn't it? As we talked this morning's lesson, John Kaplan's excellent, excellent class. In fact, if you weren't here, you need to listen to that. He talked about the remnant. And a lot of times our actions, even as leaders, the calculus cannot be how many people are following. Cannot be. Has to be the right thing. At April 12th, or April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, walked into Columbine High School with two 20-pound propane bombs that they weren't smart enough to get set off. So they go to Plan B. They go in with a bunch of weapons and guns that they'd cached. And they begin this killing spree. And out of that, one of the greatest myths have come, which is a book called She Said Yes. And that book was about Cassie Bernal. And Cassie was supposedly, or Bernal, and she was supposedly asked, do you believe in God? And she supposedly, allegedly said yes. And so she was martyred for that. All the churches picked that up, these community church movements. There was one that's 10,000 strong out of Colorado Springs, used that for altar calls all the time, and they had hundreds of kids coming and supposedly being converted. Well, I got news for them. They weren't converted, and number two, the story is not true. It's a myth. Some people would like to tenaciously hang on to a myth because they thought that was more powerful. The pastor of that particular man-made church said, it doesn't matter what the facts are, we will never let go of it because it's too powerful. You know, I've tried to teach my family, and I probably haven't done a very good job, but I've tried to teach them that the truth is so much more powerful than myth in any situation, particularly in history. And in this particular instance, I'll tell you why that myth started. Cassie Bernal had a friend in there. He was a boy. He was cowering under one of the desks as well, and he was watching and hearing all of this shooting going on. And he thought Cassie was on the other side of the room, and he heard an exchange between Dylan Klebold and this girl, and he heard the firing, and of course later, Cassie was dead. So he told the investigators what he thought, and that kind of picked up its own traction. The truth is so much more powerful. On the other side of the room was a girl, Valleen Schnur. Valleen was with one of her childhood friends, this girl that had grown up together since grade school, kindergarten. Her name was Townsend, Lauren Townsend. And they were hiding under the desk, and they were watching this melee, and the fire alarms were going off, and the shots were ringing out. And then you could just imagine the terror in their hearts when the footsteps of Dylan stopped by their table, and he bent down and looked underneath. And he pumped his shotgun, and they saw the barrel come up under there. And several shots from a semi-automatic weapon were fired. 34 pellets from a point-blank range went into her arm and her upper torso. The carnage she witnessed with her friends, the other two girls under there, is indescribable. As Dylan was walking away, she didn't care about anything but one thing at that point, and she said, my God, please let me live. That was too rich for an avowed atheist like Dylan Klebold. So he turned around and he came back and he said, God, do you believe in God? Oh, she wanted to desperately say no. She wished she could just disappear. She didn't want to have to even answer the question. But then she thought about it, and she thought, live or die, there's only one thing I can say. And she said, yes, I believe in God. And then what has been described as real curiosity, Dylan, believe in God. She said, because I believe, and that's the way my parents raised me. And then she cringed, shut her eyes, and waited for her last moment. And Dylan reloads the shotgun and walks back over to her, and then is distracted by something else on the other side of the building, and walks away and continues the spree of terrors. And she figures, if I'm brave enough and courageous enough to do what I just did, I can do anything. And she crawls and drags her maimed body out of the library, down the hall and outside the building, where she runs into a task force and a SWAT team, and they whisk her away to the ambulance, and they take her to St. Anthony's, where she meets her parents. Now, don't get me wrong. Don't misunderstand what I'm going to say. If you do, certainly you can take it up with me, but I can't help but to say this and think this. My wish for us would be that every moment and every day that we could live like we were in April 20th, 2000 or 1999 in that library of Columbine, that we would be crying out every day, my God, I just want to live. Have mercy on my soul, my God. You are my rock, you are my shield, you are my strength. I cannot live alone, I cannot take one step without you. No matter what happens in this life, there's only one thing that matters. God has not called for a group of people in a large outpouring and a large response, but continues to look for the remnant, those individuals that obey the gospel, that live according to His will, that do not insist on hearing His word and then walking away thinking that's interesting, but that commit themselves and dedicate themselves to walk by it every day. And my prayer would be that Val and the rest of her friends that lived through that would have the chance and have obeyed the gospel. If you haven't heard of that phrase, it is biblical. If you haven't heard of that phrase and you don't know what that is, we would love to speak with you this morning about obeying the gospel, the only real cry out to God that will put you in His spiritual Israel, His remnant, for salvation for eternity, and all the other things in our life can go away.